Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening. Well, welcome back to the program today, Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician from Christie Clinic and is on the program once a month on a Thursday in the 10 o'clock hour. We built these into the schedule to give you this regular opportunity to ask questions about children's health. So whatever is on your mind about your kids, grandkids, nieces, nephews, the kind of things that you could imagine discussing with a pediatrician, is fair game here. And all you have to do is pick up the telephone and give us a call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, so that means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number and we'll pay for the call, 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL, if that makes it any easier. Toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Welcome back.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
Things have been pretty quiet around your place?
Things have been, the school physicals are just proceeding along, and camp physicals are done, and we're waiting for football to start.
No big epidemics, nothing serious going on.
This is our time to kind of regenerate our batteries and get ready for the flu season, but this isn't flu shot talking. This isn't... Actually... They say there's going to be a nasal vaccine for influenza this year.
Really?
So we may be seeing the end of flu shots.
Huh. Is this something that they're still sort of testing and working on, or would it be something that would be in wide use?
The representative said that it may be available this fall. So just go to your doctor's office and get a couple of sprays in the nose, and away you go. Mm-hmm. And you're immune. So, and it sounds like, from what this, now drug reps you have to take with a grain of salt, but it sounds like this may be the wave of the future in reducing the number of shots that children and adults get, is more of this stuff will be delivered by alternate routes, mainly mm-hmm. The nasal route.
Well, I didn't, now that you mentioned about, I know recently I did hear stories, and I'm sure people heard some of these stories, about the possibility that people, diabetics who have to take insulin, might be able to do it with an inhaler so that they don't have to be giving them shots. So it may be, as you say, that in the future, more and more medicines could be given that way.
Yeah, alternate routes. I guess the nasal insulin appears to be good for the type 2 diabetic. There's not much talk about it at this point in time for the type 1 or the juvenile onset diabetic. And it appears that it will be supplemental, it may be supplemental for them and not a replacement for the injections at this time. So for the type 1 diabetics, there doesn't look to be any great windows opening in the immediate future, but oftentimes when windows open, they open all of a sudden too. And so, but the nasal insulin, probably for the type 2 diabetic at this time, probably not for the type 1 or the juvenile onset diabetic. But yeah, it looks like things are
improving.
Well,
that's progress. I guess on behalf of the children, both children and pediatricians of America, fewer shots. This is okay. We're okay with that idea.
I'm okay.
Even as a grown-up, when I go and have my yearly flu shot, have the tiniest little bit of that thing left over from being a kid. It says, oh, really, do you have to stick me with that thing?
Yeah, I think I think you have to be a little sadistic to look forward to injections, but then again, to be a little phobic, to be terrified of them.
Yeah. Well, I went out, and actually this month I gathered up a couple of things thinking that I could, most of the time, I'm too lazy to do that. But for some reason, this time around, I went out and looked for some things you might talk about. So here, under the heading of things that parents worry about and maybe can't do very much about, here recently, it's been reported, apparently, that we think a significant number of young Americans may have some measurable hearing loss. And the reason is, here's the dad angle, loud noise. So we're talking about fireworks, lawnmowers, rock concerts, perhaps listening to stereo too loud, wearing your Walkman and having it cranked up as much as possible, and all kinds of environmental noise, some of which perhaps is avoidable, but not all. And this was based on a survey of something like 5,200 people, and they're making this big estimate. Of course, you always got to be maybe a little careful about these estimates, but they're estimating that maybe more than 5 million young people have some degree of hearing loss, and from apparently exposure to environmental noise. What do you think about that?
I think that's been known for years, and that environmental noise, and I think it's been well known that the rock band players who are exposed to it all the time have problems with it. Mm-hmm. I'm a woodworker, a kindling maker, maybe it'd be a more appropriate word, but I think in the woodworking journals now we're hearing about the amount of decibels that a sander puts out or a table saw puts out. So I think we're not just talking about teenagers with Walkmen on their ears all the time. I think we're talking about adults with hobbies such as woodworking or that sort of thing, that we do know that sustained loud noises can cause hearing loss in the long run. Fortunately, most of these here, we're not talking about deafness, but we're talking about hearing loss that may deprive you some of the pleasures in life. Maybe you won't hear your expensive stereo that you've paid for. You'll miss some of the sounds from that. So I think it's a good idea to start talking about your kids and teenagers about noise. And I think, again, like bike helmets and all the other things we've talked about, it's probably a good idea as parents to set the example for your kids. Like if you are a woodworker or something like that, put hearing protectors on. And there's a variety of them, and they aren't very expensive. If you're in a loud noise situation, and kids with their Walkman, and just have them see if they can dial it down a little bit, because loud sustained noises are damaging to the hearing apparatus. And I think a related subject is, what's this going on about universal hearing tests in newborn infants? Mm-hmm. And that's certainly done in Champaign-Urbana. I don't know how many states do that by law now. So these kids are studied by brainstem evoked potentials. It's a pretty good hearing test. There's a lot of controversy about whether this should be done universally or not. We know that the yield in babies who were sick in the neonatal intensive care unit, the yield is pretty high. In the healthy infant, the yield is much, much lower. I can't remember the number. It's like 1 in 1 million or something like that. The controversy is this worthwhile? And I think what it amounts to is it's many cases done universally. The states appear to be heading this way. I think the major problem with the test is it's not a great test. It's a good test, but not a great test yet. And the problem is false negatives, or false positives, I should say. Many kids fail, and a few of these hearing losses are true. So, you know, if your child fails the hearing screen, don't get terribly upset about it. Do follow through and get it followed up. But most of the healthy infants who fail the newborn hearing test probably don't have anything wrong with their hearing. I think it's a good idea, because the sooner you get involved with these kids who have a true hearing loss, the better off they are. And clinically, unfortunately, the literature seems to suggest, and I know in my own case this is true, it's going to be 18 months to 2 years before you pick up a hearing loss in children, because they're nonverbal and they often learn to respond to body language. And since they can't hear us, since they're not verbal, we're not picking up that they're not picking up language, so they're going to be late to be clinically diagnosed. And so I think these newborn hearing screens are good. And I think hearing protection later in life in loud noise areas is a good idea too.
Yeah. So that's in this particular study, I think that really is the bottom line, that the people who conducted it said that this kind of problem is preventable. All you need to do is to encourage kids, if they're doing some kind of noisy activity, as you suggest, like if you're working with power tools and they put out a lot of noise and you're in a kind of a confined space, wear hearing protection, and that should pretty much take care of it. All right. Our guest this morning, Dr. Robert Bochak. He's a pediatrician from Christie Clinic in Champaign and is on the show every month. And we talk about children's health. And your questions are welcome. We have somebody ready to go in Champaign right here, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just thought I'd like to excuse me, I would like to contribute. My daughter listened to the Walkman of her children, set it at a volume that she felt was adequate, and then taped it and told them that if the tape came off, it was the end of the Walkman. Also, my brother, who has worked, he was a white-collar worker, but he was on the shop floor a lot in an automotive manufacturing company, and he put on the ear protectors every time he went on the floor for 40 years. And all his buddies are wearing hearing aids. He has a slight loss, but very little. And I just thought I would contribute that to the subject this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, very good.
These hearing protectors are indeed hearing protectors. I think they don't block out the noise completely. They just reduce it by 10 to 20%. So you can still hear the whine of your saw if something's going wrong. And I think you could still, on a shop floor, you could still, if your machine is winding, it doesn't sound right, you're still going to hear it. It's not blocking out the noise. It's just reducing the noise level. So you can still hear what's going on.
Okay. To Urbana for someone else. This is line number two. Hello.
Oh, hello. I have a slightly different question, not related to hearing, but my 13-year-old daughter seems to have a problem with creaking bones.
Okay.
Well, what I mean is we live in a carpeted house, and when she's coming down the hall, I can hear her coming, even if she's walking in bare feet, because her ankles seem to, they don't snap and they don't pop, but they sort of creak, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And she and I laugh about it a lot, but she says it doesn't hurt. And it's been going on, I guess, for about a year and a half, but I was just wondering if it was related to growing, you know, like is it something that she's going to grow out of eventually?
Yes, probably. And I think the difference between her and mine is when mine creak, they hurt.
Yeah.
Hers don't hurt.
Right.
And they're not swollen, and she has no unexplained fevers. I mean, she's perfectly fine in every way.
Yeah.
This is benign.
Okay.
Yeah, this is benign. It's not benign. I did have one teenager who had problems with it because his ankles seemed to snap, so he could never come in after curfew and sneak past his parents' room because they heard it all the time. And
Right. That's what it's like with her. I can hear her coming. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you. Other comments, questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's the number if you're in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. We also have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number and the calls on us. That's 800-222-9455. So do you don't see, or do you sometimes see the beginnings of joint problems in adolescence? Can you?
Sure, we can see it I've got an 8-year-old boy now or 9-year-old boy now we will see rheumatoid arthritis in childhood, and it can occur much earlier than childhood, even in infancy sometimes. So you can see it. It's quite uncommon, but you can see it.
Well, let me ask about something else that has been in the news lately, or at least I picked up on this. Was from Jane Brody's column last week in the New York Times, her personal health column. And she's writing about fever and the fact that apparently it's something that concerns parents a lot. And this was, she quotes here from a report that was done by some folks at Johns Hopkins. Fever apparently is one of the most common reasons that parents seek medical attention for their kids. And the point of this seems to be that that parents are maybe too worried, maybe more worried than they need to be about fever. Now, of course, fever can be a sign that there's something going on. Fever can be a sign that there's infection. You know, that can be certainly reason to be concerned about it. And a high sustained fever is not a good thing just to let it go. But so then the question is, well, how do you think about fever? How much is appropriate worry and how much is too much worry?
Yeah, and I think the way I like to look at fever, and we've talked about fever phobia in the past, and I think it's been a problem we pediatricians have dealt with for years and years. And I think, you know, we tell parents, don't worry about fever. Fever's not harmful. It's probably helpful. Look at the circumstances. But then the first thing we get, you parents get when you call us and ask for advice is, how high is your child's fever? So I think we contribute to the fever phobia too. But I think fever is a sign of what's going on, and fever of and by itself is not something to worry about. It's something that to catalog, I guess. You know, my child's got fever. They seem to be in pain. They're coughing. They're having trouble breathing. They're unarousable. And I think so you put fever in conjunction with the other symptoms going on, but there's not any good evidence that fever by... Well, there is good evidence that fever by itself doesn't cause any harm. It's a sign or symptom of something going on, usually an infection. We talked about juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. There's a systemic kind that will have fever. So it's a sign or symptom that we catalog. But of and by itself, you don't need to worry about it until it reaches perhaps 108 degrees. And I've never seen 108 degree fever from an infection of any kind. You get 108 degree fever if you lock a kid in the car with the windows shut in the parking lot. So please don't do that, especially when it's as hot as it is outside. But I think, yeah, don't get concerned about fever by itself. Put that in conjunction with what else, with however else your child is acting. If they're, and I've seen my kids and other children, running around the office with 104 fever, acting like there's nothing wrong with. In their world, and that's the kind of fever where, if you want, give some antipyretic, some acetaminophen or ibuprofen or something like that to help reduce that fever and make the child a little bit more comfortable, maybe. But fever of and by itself, you don't generally need to worry about. Put it in conjunction with whatever else is going on with the child, with however else the child is acting, whatever other signs and symptoms they have.
Okay. We have several callers here now in line, so we'll get back to phones. And first is Champagne. This is line one. Hello.
Yeah, this is back to the issue of hearing. And this sort of, I guess it partly relates to children, but partly just relates to hearing protection in general. I started wearing hearing protection when I was in my teens, doing various, machine tasks, et cetera, et cetera. The one thing I've found is that for music purposes, I can't stand them because they basically have an equalization curve that screws up the harmonic frequencies pretty substantially. And so my question is, I wonder if and perhaps an audiologist would know this better, if there's some kind of hearing protection that's very flat and doesn't mess up. Because what happens is the standard hearing protection really attenuates the highs substantially.
More than the lows.
And doesn't do anything to the lows. And so what happens is when you hear something, it's all bass.
Okay.
And so I don't know whether you know of anything like that.
No, I don't. No, I don't know of anything, except I do know they make hearing protectors with radios in them now.
So you can pick up
reception, and which worries me a little bit, because how can you have a hearing protector with the noise blasting in your ear from the radio? But I'm not sure, where you, and we'd have to talk to an audiologist, but I think I don't know how these work and how you can get one that will dull all sounds the same amount, all frequencies the same amount.
Or at least closer. I recognize it's not going to be perfect, but it would be nice if it was closer. Because for going to, say, concerts or something, I always hate when I come out and my ears are dead. Now, this, of course, is a matter that teenagers have. I went to a lot more concerts when I was 17 than I do now. But one thing I will say, just as a warning, is if you're going to have your kids use hearing protector, which I do recommend, it's a good idea, and let them keep their hearing as long as they can, you got to watch them because they're putting something in their ear.
Yeah. Nothing bigger than your elbow is ever supposed to go in your ear.
Except for your
hearing protector.
Right. So I guess that's why I say that this is quite relevant. I remember once getting something stuck in there, and I eventually got it out myself. I just worked. I think I used some rubbing alcohol, and it shrank the foam enough that I was able to pull it out. But because the foam doesn't like rubbing alcohol well at all, as you might imagine. But so that's just one of those warnings that anybody who's giving these to their kids, you got to be careful.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. We'll keep going here. The next person in line is in Savoy. It's line number two. Hello.
Hello. I have a question or a concern that has to do with babies in car seats that are facing the rear view windows with no sun blocking device. And I'm wondering what the medical consequences would be for that child being exposed to the direct sunlight over a period of time on their eyes. You know, it's kind of an alert. I've seen this a couple different times at stop signs where, or stoplights where babies have been directly exposed to that sunlight. And I'm wondering if you can get a medical alert out if you see this as a problem.
You know, I've never, I don't know that that's been looked at. I've never seen anything published about that.
Okay. I called a couple of the television stations to see if they could research it and get the alert out, because those babies, you know, 3 months or 4 months that have no sun blockage and their little eyes, and I've seen their eyes directly with that sun glaring into it, could create a problem down the road, or maybe sooner than down the road, you know, on their eyes. So I'm just wondering if you
can do
something about that.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I guess what I will say, you know, what I do know is probably the safest place for a baby to be in a car seat is in the middle seat position in the back seat, which will take care of some of that sun exposure, won't it?
It would, but this I have seen a couple of times, and that's why I thought I need to call
and
see if somebody can do some research, either put out an alert to parents. I know there may be sun blocking devices you can put on the back window. It ought to be mandatory if babies have to be strapped in where they're facing that rear view window. There ought to be something mandatory that their eyes be blocked from the sun.
Yeah, and I don't know. I think most cars have tinted windows, but I don't know if they're tinted enough.
Yeah, with the sun, you know, the way it would be directed, it doesn't look like it from what I've seen, observed, you know, with cars sitting next to me. So,
and then I've seen pull-down shades on cars, too. Yeah. And I expect if you go to the stores, you can probably get a tinted plastic thing that will probably stick to that window, too.
Yeah, but don't you think that ought to be something that needs to be an alert put out for parents that maybe have never thought of it? You know, they strap the child into the seat. I know the babies can be, or children can be strapped the opposite way, but I guess when they're, you know, the infants have to be strapped in facing the rear view.
Yeah.
So if there's anything you can do to get out an alert or something, so these parents realize it, would be good.
Good point. I wish I could answer that better, but I've never seen any real data on, on that eye damage, although we do know that, you know, sunlight is probably not good for eyes.
If you look directly at the sun, and that's what, you can't tell an infant to keep their eyes closed if the sun is coming in. So
poor kid doesn't have any choice.
Right. So if you can do something, you know, to put out an alert or whatever. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, there is, I know that there is concern for people of all ages about ultraviolet exposure and the damage that it can do to the eye. And so for that reason, I guess people are, it's recommended if you're going to be outside and it's a bright day, either you wear sunglasses, or if you wear optical prescription eyeglasses like we do, you can get UV coating on the lens that will take care of that problem. So what do you think about putting sunglasses on small children?
Yeah, I think the problem is
they don't stay on.
So I think we have to do something more, a little bit more passive for young children. And I suppose, you know, we just got done talking about too much noise being bad for hearing, and that, I don't know that anybody's looked at how much light comes in through the windows of a car and whether it is too much light. And it strikes me as, since we don't have any data, we certainly can't do any damage by toning down the light that's hitting these kids' eyes until we do have good data and something. I think it might be a good idea to, you know, put a visor up of some kind, or get one of those little pull-down sunshades or something for the eyes to keep sun out of the baby's eyes.
A little bit past the midpoint here, our guest, Dr. Robert Bocek from Christie Clinic. He's here each month on a Thursday. We talk about children's health. And if you have questions, anything we've talked about, it could be, of course, could be anything else. It could be anything that you'd think of asking a pediatrician. That's certainly fine. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Someone else here to talk with in Eureka, line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a dietary inquiry about asthma. Mm-hmm. On a recent news release, they said that they were beginning to see some evidence that fatty acids might influence asthma, causing or contributing to it or something like that. And one of the things that they talked about the trans fatty acids, which come from the hydrogenated materials. And then they also talked about polyunsaturates with omega-6. Now, I understand what omega-3 is. You get it from fatty fish and stuff like that. But have you heard about omega-6 from polyunsaturated oils?
No, I'm afraid I'm without basis there.
They were warning, they're saying asthma might be induced somewhat by fats,
yeah,
artificial fats.
I think, boy, we've got a lot of, you know, I think the problem I have with nutrition and what's coming out, what happens is the research data gets picked up out of the journals and the preliminary article gets picked up. The might cause it, and the media seems to present it as there's a definite link here, and I think we need to be careful because a lot of these preliminary studies are based on, they're good studies, you know, but they're very preliminary, and most of these studies, if you read the original study, it says, you know, this study's got limitations to it. The study design was such, or our data is such, or our numbers are small, that, you know, this is something that we're looking at. This is something that we wish other centers would look at, too, to see if we've got something wrong with our study design. And they're only maybes at this time. So I don't think people in general should get terribly excited about, you know, and really alter their lifestyles based on a lot of this preliminary data on whatever vitamin or whatever fatty acid or whatever nutrient there is in the diet. I think at this time, as far as I know about asthma, we don't know. It's environmental, yes. It probably has something to do with genetics, yes. What the gene is and what it is doing or not doing and how we can interfere with that, I don't think we've got any clinical, you know, anything really concrete that we can say. So I think we're still stuck with the med, and we've come a long ways, but we're still stuck with medications and saying, gee, we really don't know how to stop asthma.
Yeah, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you. And again, other questions are welcome. Whatever's on your mind, as long as it has to do with children's health, you are invited to call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just and a sort of related item, going back to the thing we were talking about with the fever. The American Academy of Pediatrics earlier this month put out a report. They are recommending that people get rid of their old mercury-containing thermometers, the old-fashioned kind that we all grew up with. The concern being, I guess, that even though there's not a lot of mercury in any particular thermometer, that we should reduce the potential for exposure to mercury. And so they're suggesting that it'd be better off if we got rid of those and then people went out and got one of the new digital kind that are probably a lot easier to use, easier to read, and maybe just, you know, a better device for doing the job.
Yeah, and I think I can support that. But I think, again, I think there's been a little bit of terrorism about the amount of mercury in a mercury thermometer. There's very little mercury. The other thing is pure mercury. If you swallowed the mercury, fresh mercury out of a mercury thermometer, it would probably just pass through because we don't absorb the pure metal very well. It's when it oxidizes that we can absorb it very well. Mercury is a toxin. The other concerns, and the mercury thermometer obviously contains mercury. I don't know how many there are still out there anyway. I think everybody's gone digital because they're less than $10 now. They're accurate. Nobody can read the old mercury thermometers anyway, especially those of us who have bifocals already. So I think the digital electronic thermometer is a much better thing to have than the... If you shake it, it doesn't break like the mercury thermometers do. And I think that's the problem. You break a mercury thermometer, you can't find that mercury, and it lays around and oxidizes. And then if the child eats it and there's enough of it, there could be toxicity. So I recommend everybody ought to have a digital thermometer. Okay. It works the same as the mercury, oral or rectal. I do not like the ear thermometers. I don't think anybody likes the ear thermometers except the ear thermometer companies, because they are inaccurate. They're inaccurate high, they're inaccurate low. They're just not very dependable at this time. So I think everybody with a child, or probably every household, ought to have a digital thermometer, except now we're contributing to the fever phobia we just talked about earlier. I think the digital thermometer is the way to go.
What about the kind that you use in the armpit?
Does that
give you a good reading?
Yeah. Well, okay. Yes. Okay, the gold standard for temperature, the core temperature, is probably best measured rectally. Mm-hmm. You lose a little bit of accuracy if you measure it orally. You use it a little bit more if you measure it under the arm, depending on how cooperative the child is. But again, we talked about fever earlier, and we said we really don't care whether that temperature is 102 or 103 or 104. It probably doesn't give us any data. So if we lose a little accuracy and we're off by half a degree or a degree, it's sort of a who cares in the situation of things. We're in the ballpark, and I think what we want is sort of a plus or minus. There's a fever present or there's not a fever present. Mm-hmm. What we really need is a thermometer that says, take this kid to the doctor. They need help. Or don't worry about this illness. It's insignificant. It's a virus that's going to go away by itself.
Yeah. And it's interesting that Brian Wagner, the guy who's at the board, said apparently also there are some organizations that collect the old thermometers.
Yes.
And I guess there again, from the strictly environmental point of view, if you're going to get rid of it, you probably should not just throw it in the trash.
Yeah.
Because here's the same question is, well, where ultimately does that mercury end up going? And
into the groundwater,
or, you know, into the landfill, or what if it gets broken along the way and it gets spilled somewhere? So
recycles these? I don't know. I don't know what you do with it. Don't bring it to my office, please.
Don't bring it here to WIL either. We're going to have a big mercury drive one of these days. That's what we'll do. Well, your questions are welcome. You want to call in and talk with Dr. Bocek, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL.
But I remember as a kid playing with mercury, don't you? Chasing it around.
Where you could see people would actually put it in your hand, put it in and roll it around, and it was a great sort of...
And it wasn't shiny, was it? It was kind of a dirty gray. It was oxidized.
Yeah.
It was absorbable and toxic.
Yeah.
Just think how much brighter we could have been if...
We could have been brilliant, but no. All right. Well, anyway, other questions, welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL.
You know, I think what we've talked about a lot this morning so far is taking an active role in our health care, isn't it? Protecting ourselves against loud noises. And I think to a certain extent as a physician, I feel that, you know, I'm getting kind of dumped on. Doctor, give me the vaccine that's going to keep my kid from getting meningitis. Well, I can't because we don't have one. Mm-hmm. You know, it's why isn't there a state law about this? And I think it's about, you know, taking an active role in our own health care and preventative medicine, using hearing protection, using head protection for bike riding and scooter riding and that sort of thing, using appropriate safety restraints for our young children in the car, our infants and young children in the car, and what we're talking about is appropriate restraints up to 80 or 90 pounds now, some kind of booster seat or something like that to get the seat belts and shoulder harnesses in the proper position. We're talking about teaching our kids to turn their Walkman down to a decent level. I mean, when I can hear, sitting next to you or 10 feet away from you, hear the music from your Walkman quite well, it's probably up a little bit too loud. We're talking about, I saw two motorcyclists yesterday when we were driving, you know, riding double on a Harley without motorcycle helmets on. That's the sort of thing we're talking about. Taking an active role in our own preventive medicine and keeping ourselves as safe as possible. I know Jack Brighton, the producer's daughter, has a broken arm. Well, that one couldn't have been prevented. That was a accidents are going to happen, but I think we can do our best to minimize the accidents. Said we don't have data on sunlight coming through a car window in a child's eyes. Well, let's not wait for data. If it looks, the child's kind of uncomfortable with it, let's take an active role ourselves and use our own intuition and say, I don't know if it's bad for the child's eyes or not, but the child's kind of uncomfortable with that light shining in there. Let's see what we can do that helps protect this child a bit or make the child more comfortable in this case.
Okay. We have about 10 minutes left in the show. If you have a question or a comment or you'd like to call in and talk with our guest, Dr. Robert Bochak. He's a pediatrician from Christie Clinic. This is our monthly program on children's health. We always do it on Thursday in the 10 o'clock hour, and we've built it into the schedule to give you this regular opportunity to ask questions of a pediatrician. So whatever's on your mind, it doesn't need to be anything that we've talked about. It could be anything that has to do with children's health here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line that's good anywhere you can hear us, around Illinois, western Indiana, any place that signal will travel, that's 800-222-9455.
Let's talk about immunizations, because I hate to skip that on a program.
Sure.
The DT, diphtheria tetanus booster vaccine that all ninth graders get, that you're supposed to get every 10 years. For whatever reasons, I don't know exactly, there is a nationwide shortage of that now. So no ninth grader, we're not giving, I don't think anybody is giving the booster dose to ninth graders routinely at this time. The shortage is supposed to be corrected in the next year, 2002. There are supplies, though, for you folks who step on pitchforks and rusty rakes and that sort of stuff. There are adequate supplies to take care of those people with tetanus-prone wounds, and that's the kind of the deep penetrating wound off of a pitchfork, a rake, a shovel, that sort of thing. So, you may have read about the shortage, but if you've got a tetanus-prone wound or a wound you think is tetanus-prone, please talk to your physician. The vaccine is available. It's being restricted to necessary use only instead of booster dose use only. But don't worry about your ninth grade. They will get into ninth grade next year. They won't be excluded because they don't have up-to-date immunizations. But those of you who have a gardening accident or some kind of accident, please contact your healthcare provider and make sure that you get a booster dose if you need it.
Well, that's, that gets a question that I have thought about a little bit recently about tetanus. The fact is that tetanus is out there in the environment. It's not something that's inherent in rusty nails. Yeah. The idea is that it's out there and that it's opportunistic. And if you should happen to have a puncture wound, then it's possible that the tetanus will get in there. And sort of that, I guess that made me wonder about, when you are out doing yard work, maybe you're really coming in contact with the soil, you're digging, you're planting stuff, whatever it is, whatever it is you're doing. How concerned do you need to be about cuts and scrapes and things like that?
Okay.
Keeping them clean and so
it's forth. It's an anaerobe, so a cut or a scrape, a superficial cut or scrape and that sort of thing, you don't need to worry about. It has to be anaerobic or low oxygen environment. The spore likes a low oxygen environment. So, the minor cuts and scrapes and that sort of stuff that are open, that are not deep penetrating injuries, you really don't need to worry about. You don't need an extra booster dose for those at all. So get your 10-year, get one every 10 years. So that means you adults out there who haven't had one since your ninth grade booster are probably behind. In the year 2002, when the vaccine shortage corrects itself, please get updated. But for the minor wounds like that, the risk of tetanus is very low. What we're talking about more is the penetrating wound. So it's not the rusty nail. It's the dirt on the rusty nail,
right,
stepping on it, penetrating the foot. penetrating the leg or whatever. So you have a fairly deep penetration. That's the one to worry about.
Not just any break in the skin.
Yeah, not the scrape, the scratch.
Okay. Well, one other thing, I thought I might ask you about, an article I came across. Apparently, sometimes there are parents who are breastfeeding who worry that if they give the baby a pacifier, just to, you know, give them something to do with their mouth, that that will lead to premature weaning from breastfeeding. And apparently a study has come out that says that it was a study that was published in the AMA journal, basically says you don't have to worry about that. And I guess that it has been the case that some organizations have discouraged parents from using pacifiers because there were some studies that showed there was this relationship between pacifiers and early weaning. And now this yet another study, this one that's this article appeared in the AMA journal, says, and this was just I guess within the last couple of days, says don't worry about it. If you want to give the kid a pacifier, it's okay.
Except their ear infection incidence will be higher.
It's always something, isn't it?
Those pacifiers are, you know, teach your child to smoke cigarettes at an early age. Did they? No. Yeah, there's been a lot of bad stuff written about pacifiers. It increases ear infections. I wasn't aware of this on early weaning, but we're big into breastfeeding now. So, yeah, I think the problem with these studies is what else is going on? Are they looking at pacifiers and how well have they controlled the study for other things? When did these parents want to wean in the first place? It seems, in my opinion, that children seem to be willing to wean between 9 and 12 months. It seems to be a natural now. As they go to table food, we move them to the cup. Probably breastfeeding used to, I don't know how many hundreds of years ago, last till 2, 2.5 years of age. I don't know what the right time to really wean is. I still like to do it for, you know, at 9 months to a year seems to be a natural weaning time. I don't mind pacifiers. I have nothing against pacifiers. If it makes your life more pleasant, contents the baby. I've never seen a baby starve to death or lose weight because they were too busy sucking on the pacifier to eat. I think the hunger pains are powerful incentives, and they won't. The pacifier doesn't satisfy them. So my feeling is, if your baby likes a pacifier, go ahead and give them a pacifier. Mm-hmm. I think usually what I will tell parents is after age one or so, you know, the pacifier, maybe start separating the pacifier from the child. It goes in the crib or the bed, and it's used for sleep purposes. It's used for solace when they've fallen and skinned their knee. I don't mind seeing an 18-month-old suck a pacifier in the office because for 18 months old, I'm pretty threatening too, and they need a little extra solace there. But I don't have anything particular. I tend to disregard the data that pacifiers are terrible things.
Mm. And there's nothing to worry about in terms of dental sort of issues, teeth development, or anything like that?
I think the problem is some kids have a big non-nutritive sucking need. And my feeling is if you don't give those children a pacifier, they're gonna find a thumb, or they're going to find their fingers, which may be worse than a thumb, or they're going to find a blanket or something. So I think they will fulfill their sucking need, and I don't think we can really prevent it. So maybe the orthodontic-shaped pacifier may really be better for them. But I think my opinion is I think way too many papers have been published on pacifiers, and I think there's maybe we could look at the sun coming through a car window damage. might be more appropriate.
That'd be something more important for us to be thinking about.
I think as far as teeth are concerned, yeah, there's been a lot written on that too. Thumb sucking, that pushing teeth in malalignment. I guess I have two responses to that. What child doesn't get to see the orthodontist for some reason or other? And one of my children sucked her thumb for a prolonged period of time. She was about 9 or 10 when it stopped. Well, she got braces anyway, every child does. But it was kind of interesting when she finally did stop using her thumb to see the overbite correct itself just with the tension of the, it seemed to be just with the tension on the upper lip or something, seemed to bring those teeth into position. Now, not satisfactory to an orthodontist, of course, but They demand perfection in alignment, but it was interesting to watch the teeth go in by themselves. The other thing that's said is if they give it up by the time their permanent dentition starts coming in, so around six or seven or so, there's probably, you know, it may buck their baby teeth, but the permanent teeth will probably come erupt just fine if they give up thumb sucking pacifiers and that by six or seven when the permanent dentition's starting to move in.
Okay. We have probably a couple minutes left. Is there anything that you'd like to mention?
You know what, folks? It's hot out there. It's real hot out there. So watch your children. You know, maybe find something to do. Rent a VCR or something for them in the afternoon. Take them to the movies in the afternoon. Take them to a museum in the afternoon. Outrageous suggestion in the summer. Encourage them to read a book. Make sure they have plenty of fluid offered to them if they are outside in that, plenty of shade. But I think this is in this hot weather, when
the heat index is over 100.
That's right. When the farmers are beginning to worry about their cattle, their animals, I think it's time for us to worry about our children. And we can offer them air conditioning. It's time to bring them inside during the, what's Ed Kieser like to say, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m.
Yeah, when the sun is at its highest,
it's
beating down most directly. The rays are most intense.
And this is an overcast day, so unfortunately they won't feel the sun. So I think this is a particular time for parents to intervene and say, I know the sun's not shining brightly and you're not feeling it, but come on in. We'll find something to do in the cool.
Okay. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Dr. Robert Bocek, he's a pediatrician from Christie Clinic. He's on the program every month, always on Thursday in the 10 o'clock hour, and we talk about children's health.